having a Bible reading done for you, sabotage the person who you've asked to read before they start reading. Greg was entirely right. I had asked to read Luke 1, 1-4 first, but I didn't hear him say 2, 1-7, and I had that momentary panic of a preacher where you think, oh no, am I preaching on the wrong verses today? But lo, we are in Luke 2, 1-7, but that Luke 1, 1-4 will come in useful. I apologise to people also who might not be able to hear me properly. My voice is sort of going, so I'm probably going to run a little bit short today, and we'll get through with me still able to speak by the end of the sermon. And my name's Mike, I'm one of the pastors here. And it's a real privilege to be able to speak to you at the start of our sort of relatively short Advent series. I'm also speaking in another 2 weeks' time when church on the 24th of December will not be here because we don't have the school over Christmas, but will be taking place in my house. So I might just do that sermon, you know, maybe from bed, and you can all sort of gather around, and it'll be a very family atmosphere. No, Liz's not going to let that happen. Well, this morning we're talking about this idea of Advent and preparation, but the theme of our Advent series is a thrill of hope, and we're talking this morning about making space for hope. And before I go into that a bit more, I want to talk about the problem of kibble. Oh, the feedback stopped just at that point, which was a perfect silence for everyone to be, what are you talking about? Yes, kibble. Kibble, we're going to talk about kibble. Maybe I should back up a little bit. This idea of kibble comes from a book that I read about last year, and it's a book that got made into a film which you might have heard of. It's the film Blade Runner. I'll do a show of hands. Who's seen Blade Runner? There we go, people who've seen Blade Runner. If you've not seen Blade Runner, definitely go and see Blade Runner. And Blade Runner is not, I must say, the conventional movie one kicks off a Christmas sermon with. You don't tend to get Blade Runner mixed with Christmas, or maybe you do. Blade Runner is a film set in a dystopian future, although actually it's titled as being set in 2019, in which there are androids and they are being hunted by this cop, Deckard, who has to go around, and there isn't actually a Christmas tree, unfortunately. But that's based on a book called Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? Which is a far more weird title. And the book is you can tell why Ridley Scott, the director of Blade Runner, took a few elements of the book and then left a lot of the rest. The book has a lot of weird obsessing over animals, like everyone is comparing what pets they have, like I've got a robot sheep and you've got a robot goat, so I am better than you kind of thing. It's a really strange thing. It takes up a weirdly large amount of the book if you're ever going to read it. You think you're reading this kind of cool sci-fi film noir, but actually it's a lot of debating around the price of different electric animals. But there is a character in this book who does make it into the film. He's changed a bit in the film. In the film, he's like a toy maker. And the reason he's a toy maker in the film is because the description of him in the book is a bit more offensive. He's described in a sort of, I guess, an unpolitical way of saying someone who has sort of learning disabilities. And this guy has a problem, and the problem he observes is kibble. In this world, this dystopian future where just humanity, like civilization, is just sort of falling away, people are leaving the planet to go and live in space because it's better out there. This character, this person who is seen by the rest of society as someone who is a bit dim, a bit out of it, has noticed something. These buildings, these huge abandoned buildings that all these people live in, should be kind of the same as they were, right? If you abandon a building, it shouldn't change day to day or week to week or month to month. But what he notices is that over time, somehow, despite no one living there, the buildings get more cluttered. And not just like they're falling apart, but like there's just stuff there that wasn't there before. There's rubbish, there's refuse, there's things that happen. And he comes up with his own theory of the universe. And his theory is around kibble. The idea that if left unattended, kibble simply grows. It's clutter that just expands to fill the space that it occupies. It's like a gas. So if you don't deal with the kibble, if someone doesn't come and clean up every once in a while, a place just gets dirtier and messier until there's no space for anything else. There's no space for anyone to live. And for all it's a little bit weird as a concept, we see this in our own world. There is a theory around the idea of if a building has a broken window, eventually the rest of the windows of the building get broken. If you repair the window, the rest of the windows don't get broken. Why does that happen? And it's the same with things like litter on the streets. A few pieces of litter left unattended, and suddenly there's more litter on that street. And this is the same in our own lives. We have clutter that grows, things that we've left around. They're on the floor. They're not in the way as they are. They're not tidy either. They're just there. And we think, well, it's okay. It's just over there. I can still walk past it. It's not nice. It's unsightly. I can still get through. But then over time, we look back and we go, that pile's bigger than it was yesterday, isn't it? There's a few more things. It's got some sharp edges now. It's fine, but I can still get past. And over time, it grows and grows and grows until we can't get past, until there's no space for anything else. And what kind of clutter have we let grow? And what does this have anything to do with the passage we're talking about today? Well, a lot of that clutter will be the things that we carry with us about our spiritual lives, about the faith that we hold on to and that we talk about, maybe a lot more at Christmas time than at other times of the year. And when we talk about that faith and we talk about what Jesus has done for us, there can be those parts of kipple, those things that have been left unattended, those doubts or concerns we've had, or those hurts we've had at a certain interaction or a certain church that we've just sort of left to one side, hoping we'll just ignore them, keep them off to the side. But over time, those grow. And over time, those change the way we perceive the problem itself. The problem has become much bigger than it started out. And when I was given the passage, Luke 2, to preach on, I found one of those large elements, I think, of sometimes unattended kipple. People might not know, but they might know, Luke 2, 1 to 3 is a rather controversial passage because of the way it describes the history. It's a fairly familiar passage. We're familiar with the idea that there was a census, and that's why Mary and Joseph had to go to Bethlehem. Luke 2 is quite specific in how it talks about that. In those days, Caesar Augustus, so he was the newly crowned emperor of Rome, or relatively new. He was the person who transitioned Rome from being a republic to an empire, sort of dispensed with the vestiges that other people could have control in a democratic format and just decided, we're going to do this whole empire thing. Star Wars jumper. And he said he was going to do a census. And it then has this bracketed point. This was the first census, look in verse 2, sorry, that took place while Quirinius was governor of Syria. I don't know who Quirinius was. I'm sure some of you are big Quirinius fans out there. And everyone went to their own town to register. And we know this part because we always hear about the story of Mary and Joseph going to Bethlehem. We have the donkey, we sing Little Donkey, etc. But weirdly, this passage is quite controversial. This is an element of unattended clutter because we can sort of skip past this every single time until one time someone comes and throws in that awkward question of going, hang on, I've read something about this. Well, Caesar Augustus didn't ever issue this decree. And I've read something else that points out that Quirinius wasn't governor at this time. If these things are untrue, how can we trust what Luke says next? If you can't get through the simple facts of history, how can we trust that angels came to shepherds on a hill? How can we trust that this baby that was being born that people seemed to care about so much was even the Son of God? And so we have an element of kipple, of something we need to get through. And maybe you came into church this morning blissfully unaware of this controversy and you think, well, why have I just laid it on you? Well, eventually you're going to encounter this. You're going to encounter someone who is saying, hang on, this narrative, this little story we tell at Christmas, it is just a story. It is just this idea we tell ourselves because we need a festival to lighten up our year from the weather outside, and it's just something pleasant for the kids. It's not true. It's made up. For us to have faith in a real God who came to our real lives, it has to be more than just made up. It has to be more than just a story. And that means these words have to be accurate. And so the two objections to this passage, I'll explain them briefly, and then we'll have a look at how they're handled. The objections are firstly to the census. There are three main objections to a census. One is that there is no written record of Caesar Augustus saying, carry out a census of the whole Roman world. Number two is that at the time this census was taken, we know from other parts of the Bible that Herod, King Herod, was reigning in Judea. And where there was a king, the Romans didn't take censuses. King Herod would have been trusted to censor his own people, the Romans wouldn't have had anything to do with it. And the third part is this idea of everyone going to their own town. We see there's no reason you'd have to go to your own town to register. I don't know if any of you have participated in a census, but you didn't have to return to where you were born to register, I imagine. We have these three problems, and the other problem is of Quirinius. We're told that Quirinius was not governor at the time the census was apparently being taken, because Quirinius was governor in 6 AD, which was about 10 years after Herod had died. And that presents a little bit of a problem if we're also to believe that Herod went around trying to kill babies because of Jesus and the Magi talked to him. We've got a bit of a contradiction here. There's a danger that Luke will contradict the other Gospels, Matthew's Gospel. Well, we can get through a few of these because Luke is actually really interesting in how he deals with history. There's only two of the Gospels that talk the whole sort of Christmas narrative. In Mark, the shortest of the Gospels, we sort of just jump straight to Jesus was coming out of the desert and gets baptized by John. That's the first time we see Jesus. In John, we get a bit of preamble about Jesus creating the world, just a little bit there. But then we go again straight into the baptism narrative. Matthew has a mention of Jesus' family, but not a huge amount of the Christmas story. Luke is really where we get our Christmas story from. So Luke is the person who's really our main reliable source on this aspect. And we can look at the objections to the census as follows. I found I've done a good amount of reading on this, and there's a lot of sources, and I'm sure I'm not going to cover everything. I'm not going to cite a bibliography. If people want to chat to me about it or chat to Greg about it, then you can talk to us about it. But we have some interesting aspects, and these are things that are not like, oh, they're like casual excuses to the truth. No, these are true things, because often when people bring these objections, they've sort of done the same thing of, oh, I found this objection, I'm just going to take that and move on with it. We have to look into it in a bit more detail. There's actually archaeological evidence of regular censuses. We found multiple like papyruses from the Middle East at that time of different censuses. People have worked out that the Romans conducted a census roughly every 14 years, which actually makes a lot of sense, because in this country we conduct a census around every sort of 10, 11 years. So it sort of fits with the way we do things today, all the way from Roman times. And in these censuses they found sort of areas of different parts of the Roman world had censuses done at different times. And this explains why the whole idea of Caesar doing a census of the whole Roman world, well, it's just artistic license. It's like someone saying, oh, well, the Queen has decreed that all children will learn maths. It's a strange example. But the Queen doesn't say, all children, tomorrow you're doing a maths lesson. The Queen passes a law through Parliament who establish a code for the Department of Education, and the Department of Education write a curriculum, and the teachers teach a curriculum at some point in the year. It's both true to say that all the kids learn maths at different times and the teachers are responsible, as it is to say the Queen passed a law saying kids should learn maths. Both of things are equally true. They're just looked at from different angles. We also have texts from Egypt, which is the next sort of province over from Judea, that refer to asking people to return home. So again, we don't have evidence that Judea did that, but the neighbouring province of Egypt did do that. We also don't have evidence to say Judea didn't do that. So the balance sort of leads us to say, well, people in Judea might have just done the similar thing because they're the neighbouring provinces, similar people, officials in charge. And the final one is an interesting one, that Herod was at this time, he'd been demoted officially by Caesar from their word for friend to an award that meant subject. So Herod had started as the friend of Caesar, the welcomer of the Roman occupation. And then Herod had decided to sort of try and big himself up a little bit, try and get himself a bit more power in his own kingdom. And Caesar wasn't really a fan of this. He just decided to mint himself emperor of the known world. He wasn't really up for a pretender king somewhere down in Judea. So he demoted Herod at this time, which makes perfect sense then that he'd say, right, I don't trust your tax rolls anymore because I think you're skimming a bit off the top. So he's going to ask Herod to move aside and he's going to send his own people in to do the census here. So those things are handling objections to the census, handling objections to this idea that the census didn't make sense or that it wasn't at the same time or that the wrong people were doing it. They all actually make sense when we look into the details of the history of the period around us, even though we do not have a record of that census carried out at that specific time. Quirinius presents a more interesting problem. We do have history of Quirinius. We know when he was governor of Syria. We also know that he was not governor of Syria at the time when Herod was the king of Judea. So this seems like a strange thing to have in Luke's gospel. Why is it here? There are a few debates around this, and this is something that is still somewhat unsettled amongst scholars. One of the most common things is that Quirinius had other roles before he was governor. What we do know at the time that this census was taken is that Quirinius was leading an army, fighting in the sort of northern Israel, southern modern-day Syria area. But at the time, the entire province was known as Syria. So Quirinius was a leader. He was an army leader fighting a rebellion at the time. So he did have a role in the Roman government at the time. It wasn't the governor as we see it. It's been pointed out that the word governor here can just sort of mean leader. We turn it into governor because it's the most appropriate idea of how we see a governor in the modern world, and it makes sense to us to say he's the governor, because saying he's a leader of Syria just is a bit wishy-washy for us. Well, what is he, prime minister? Is he a police commissioner? Like, what's his role? But some other people say, no, the word for leader here is pretty much always used for governors, so we can't just sort of get away with that. Another translation difference, which some of you will see if you're using a digital Bible, you might see a note on the line about Quirinius, which says the first census took place before Quirinius was governor of Syria, rather than while Quirinius was governor of Syria. And again, this is a really convenient one if you just say, oh no, it says before, but then you say, well, hang on, why does the normal translation say while? And it's because, again, on the balance of probabilities, the biblical translators have to be honest. If a word just makes most sense in a certain way, and it says, no, that word is always used for while and not before, we tend to translate it as while. And so some people would say this should be translated as before, and that removes this whole contradiction. But we're not trying to do a get-out-of-jail-free card here. We're trying to be honest to what Scripture was meant to say. So the general understanding is it is while Quirinius was governor of Syria. But Luke does drop a helpful hint. He says this is the first census Quirinius took. The census of 6 AD was known as Quirinius' census. Quirinius took. But you wouldn't tend to say the first thing someone did if there wasn't a second. Luke is writing this a long time after. Quirinius could have done 20 or 30 censuses by this point, but no. We know of Quirinius' census, and then Luke says this is the first census Quirinius took. So a lot of understanding goes into the fact that maybe Luke is referring to something that we don't know. That he's saying, well, yeah, all of you know about the 6 AD census, because that was the big one that Quirinius did. This was the first one. This was the earlier census he did, whilst he was leading Syria in another capacity. We also have Luke 1 and 3 to lean on. Luke is oddly detailed. Greg read out Luke 1, where we talk about how he's writing an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus. He is writing his gospel to talk to someone who's heard about Jesus, who is maybe following Jesus, who is believing. It says, so you may know the certainty of things you've been taught. This is a really interesting position for Luke to place himself in. We don't see this from the other gospel writers. Luke is saying, my friend or my colleague, associate Theophilus, has become a Christian. And I want him to have such a deep knowledge and a certainty of that knowledge that I'm going to spend this time to write a book. Have any of you ever written a book in order to convince your friend of a point? It's not a normal thing people do. Luke has a really deep desire here to get across the truth to Theophilus. And we can see it again if we skip ahead a little bit to Luke chapter 3. This is the part I was dreading reading with my voice as it is. In the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar, when Pontius Pilate was governor of Judea, Herod, tetrarch of Galilee, his brother Philip, tetrarch of Ituria and Trachonitis, and Lysanias, tetrarch of Abilene, joined the high priesthood of Annas and Caiaphas. 8 different references in one sentence Luke uses to place when this was happening in history. This isn't the kind of way someone who's making up a fable would write. I'm going to make up this tall tale and I'm going to give you 8 historical points that you can use to contradict me if I'm wrong. Luke is very, very assured of the things he's writing here. He's putting in a lot of time and study and effort. And so there will be times when we can look through and go, well, that doesn't make sense with that one, or that doesn't make sense. Maybe some of these are just honest differences in how Luke is perceiving the world than how we would do. Whether Quirinius is the governor or an armed leader, whether Quirinius is doing a first census or his second census, or whether Augustus said they should census the whole Roman world in one go and do this massive logistical operation, or whether he just said, hey, let's start doing censuses, folks, and then 10 years later it finally gets to Judea. Who knows all of these exact things? But Luke is a detail-oriented person who has a care for Theophilus, who he's writing to. We later on see in the book of Acts that Luke actually ends up traveling with some of the early disciples. He's traveling with Paul on a ship. And so he's there. He's got first-hand knowledge of the things he's writing about. He is a studious person who gets involved in the things that he's doing. So when we see these elements in his book, there is a reason they've been put in here. And we've got a reason to question our skeptical responses. It is a relatively easy thing for someone to read something on the internet and say, oh, no, this thing that Christians believe is not true, so now I don't need to believe it. I don't need to consider it. I need to look into it. Because for many of us, Jesus represents a frustrating contradiction. He says many things that we wish would be said to and followed by everyone around us. But he also says things we desperately don't want to be true for us. And it's against this backdrop that we will dig for contradictions in Scripture. If it made no sense, just no sense at all, we read the Bible and it was like, it was a fun story, well, we could just dismiss it. We wouldn't need to feel the need to argue against it. Just like none of us are wandering around on top of Mount Olympus pointing out the lack of gods hanging around up there. But reading the biographies of Jesus, they make so much sense, so much of the time, that we then get lost in the minutiae, pulling at threads, rather than consider that there's a God who might care for us and who might care how we live our lives. We have to look past these. We have to think, why are we having these responses? Maybe these responses are a defense mechanism. Maybe they're stopping us from having to take in something that would be truly impactful and changing for us. And what's the pathway that leads away from that mindset? What's the pathway that takes us from that point of digging for contradictions, of finding something that's wrong so we don't have to take this in, to accepting it and taking it forward with faith? Well, we see another example here in the second part of our passage today, as we look at the example of Mary and Joseph. There's a great book title quote from Eugene Peterson, who wrote many books, among them the Message translation of the Bible. One of his books was titled A Long Obedience in the Same Direction. I think this is a wonderful phrase, a long obedience in the same direction. We sort of know what obedience means. In the same direction, that refers this concept of... Do you ever remember in sort of science classes being told that speed is a scalar value, whereas velocity is a vector? Anyone? No? So speed is a scalar value. Speed means I can go any speed in any direction. It doesn't matter what direction I'm going in. I'm just going a certain speed. Velocity is what we generally talk about in physics, because in physics we need to know where something's going. So velocity is speed in a direction. And actually, if you think about it, when you're driving, velocity is the important thing. You're not getting where you're going if you're going at 70 miles an hour in the wrong direction. You care very much about your velocity, and it's the same in our lives. We should care very much about not just the speed we're going at, but the direction. You go as fast as you want in the wrong way, and you won't get to where you're wanting to go. A long obedience in the same direction, pointing ourselves where? And this is where I've got to reference another movie. We didn't get a Christmas movie the first time. Will we get one this time? No, Frozen 2 is an autumn movie, actually. But people think of Frozen as a Christmas movie, so maybe this is the nearest we'll get. And this is, I mean, I've got all the pictures I found. I found the most harrowing and sad picture from Frozen 2. This is a period of Frozen 2 where, spoiler alert for anyone who's not seen Frozen 2, Olaf dies. And Anna, who is left with Olaf in the dark on her own, repeats a quote that she's heard earlier in the film, which is, I think, one of the few times that Disney have ever given me... Sam's at the window just staring at Olaf. I hope he's seen the movie, or this bit's quite disturbing for him. She repeats a quote, and actually does this whole song about it, that is one of the few times I think that Disney have impressed me with a philosophical line. A lot of the times I sort of can dismiss Disney. I heard an entire sermon once about how Let It Go is a really terrible concept. but do the next right thing, I think, is something that I can get behind. I'm aligned with the Disney Corporation on this one. Do the next right thing. What we see in verses 4 to 7 is this example from Mary and Joseph. Joseph went from the town of Nazareth in Galilee to Judea, to Bethlehem, the town of David. He went to register with Mary, who was pledged to be married to him, and was expecting a child. These verses are doing a lot of heavy lifting for describing a situation where 2,000 years ago, a man took his heavily pregnant wife on a long journey on foot or animal to a different town. They didn't go in the car. They didn't book an Airbnb in advance. They didn't know what would be awaiting them when they got there. They didn't know what level of medical care she would receive. She didn't have her green notebook, for anyone who's given birth in this country. There was no knowledge of what was going to happen next for them. And yet, they just went. Luke tends to give us an idea about what people were thinking or doing, and in this case, Luke just says they just went. Just like that. They just went off, and they trusted. They trusted God. They'd already been told that they were going to have a baby because of God. They knew God was in this. And they get there, and again, the time for the baby to be born, she gave birth and placed him in a manger, as you do. There is a simplicity to the way Luke tells this part of the story. And again, we know that Luke could embellish all of this, because the next part of Luke 2 is a lot of embellishment and a lot of incredible detail about what happens next, about the angels, about the shepherds, about the response of the world to Jesus' birth. So Luke could have put a lot of detail here as well. And the reason I imagine he didn't is because it really is this simple to Mary and Joseph. This focus on doing the next right thing, on following the simple instructions of God. They didn't know that when they got to Bethlehem whether there would or wouldn't be room. They didn't know whether the birth would or wouldn't be complicated. They didn't know what was going to happen when they tried to travel home afterwards. And their lives from this point are pretty much marked by not knowing what the next thing is going to be afterwards. So often in our lives, we have things that are in the way of us doing this. The two things I think are in the way are distractions and of not trusting. Distractions. Mary and Joseph were maybe in a time that was less distracting. I don't know. I don't know whether there were distractions back then, whether there were things that kind of interrupted suddenly into your lives, or whether you just sort of did the day-to-day. But I imagine that people were roughly the same as they are now. The same mindsets, the same ways of doing and thinking around things. The same habit, I don't know what sort of exactly way it happened, but the same habit that as you were just trying to talk to someone, you just slowly raise your phone to your... What were we saying? Sorry. And then we're just distracted, aren't we? We do it all the time. Our phones, these little buzzing devices in our pocket. Our children, these little buzzing devices in our house. All these things that suddenly pull us away from the thing we're meant to be doing, the thing that we're meant to be focusing on. Suddenly feeling, wait, did I cancel that subscription? Suddenly feeling, oh, I need to make sure I text them about the thing we're doing next week. Suddenly feeling, oh, will I have enough money in 3 months' time? All these things that suddenly just jump in. They distract us, and we let them distract us, don't we? Do we not sometimes bring it on ourselves by having devices that tell us that every single time someone likes our post on Instagram? by having a mindset that says that our the way we're perceived on social media and in our communities is more important than what we're doing on a day-to-day basis. We create distractions for ourselves by the amount of different things we feel we need to do. We need to be serving over here and doing this over here and making sure we go to this and seeing this thing because everyone's talking about it. I didn't really want to see it, but everyone else is talking about it, so I should go see it as well, shouldn't I? We make these things for ourselves, and it's because of the second item. I think we sometimes distract ourselves because actually when we stop and just face the sheer unknown of it all, it's a bit overwhelming. The sheer unknown of what is going on in the world today. What will my life be like in a year's time, in 2 years' time? I almost had a full-blown panic attack earlier this week when I was just thinking about the future of political history and whether there will be a war. I mean, maybe that's the thing I should be worrying about, but also maybe it's the thing I should be trusting God with. Why am I letting myself be consumed by that? Can I do something about it? God tells us to trust. God tells us to come to him. God told Mary and Joseph, you're going to have a baby, even though you have never done the thing that you have to do to have a baby. He says that you're going to have a baby who will be the Son of God, even though who on earth could be prepared for what that even means? And when the baby's born, shepherds show up. Why? None of us have had shepherds show up in the hospital. Just shepherds. They just have to deal with it. Keep on going. Keep on trusting God. And so do we. That's what we can see from this passage in Luke. Keep on going. Keep on trusting God. Can you figure out everything? Can you know everything? Can you dig into the Bible so deep that you're just like, yep, here it is, just plain as day. Just like I can tell you that's a chair. I can say all this. Would it really be faith if it was so plain? And I want to beware of the clean house. This isn't a call to just sweep away all that kipple. It isn't a call to just throw it out and just keep everything pristine and perfect and clean and uncluttered. Some of that clutter came from real things. It came from relationships. It came from things you care deeply about. Throwing it away is not the answer here, because later on in Luke, Jesus will warn about the idea of a house that's swept clean. He talks about casting out a demon from someone and says what happens is that demon travels through different places and eventually it gathers some friends together and it comes back and it finds that the person who it left has been swept clean, is nice and clean and empty. And so it brings all its friends along with it and they all move in. And that person is more afflicted than they were before. In that passage, Jesus is warning about this life of sort of synthetic cleanliness, you know, sort of hospital clean. We all think we want a clean house. Then you go and sit in a hospital for a while and you're like, oh, not that clean. This place feels horrible, sterile. No, we're talking about the kind of clutter removal that is removing the debris so beautiful flowers can grow. Clearing out a mossy, nasty, natty swampland and letting wildflowers spring up. Yes, there's still stuff there, but it's no longer clutter. It's meant to be there. It's filling the space with beauty and wonder. I think that's the direction our lives should be heading when we look at this long obedience. A direction that says to remove the nasty stuff, the weeds that we had talked about in our sermon on Matthew's Gospel a few weeks ago. Removing the things that choke and kill and destroy, making space, but then still growing up wonderful things afterwards. Not keeping a clean space for the sake of it being clean. Like having a house with no furniture in it and saying, this house is perfectly clean. I never want to pollute it with all that furniture. If you don't pollute it with all that furniture, no one can ever come in and sit down and join you for a meal. So in summary, I want us to think about making space. Clearing away clutter. Advent is meant to be a time of preparation. And a good question to ask when you're told Advent's a time of preparation is, preparation for what? There's no point preparing for something you're not sure. I'm meant to be preparing. Right, I'm gonna move around really fast and get a bit stressed and shout at someone. That's how I prepare for things. So let's just do that. And then someone's like, what are you preparing for? And you're like, making space to fill with hope. We fill it with hope by just doing the next right thing. We avoid the distractions, the things that get in our way. And we also avoid that, I don't want to say anxiety, because I know that can be a sort of word for some people, but avoid the things that cause us to not trust in God for our future. Do the next right thing. Focus on what's in front of us and do that and trust that God will handle the bit afterwards and the bit afterwards and the bit afterwards. Because in all this way, we take this example that Luke wants us to take from this passage, which is that a real family journeyed so that a real baby could be born, so that a real man could grow up, so that a real God could come and bring his message to us and sacrifice himself for us. See, it all started in a manger and it ended on the cross. But right towards the end, there was also a meal. There was a meal that Jesus sat down and shared with his disciples in a room which was no doubt swept clean and yet full of joy, full of purpose, full of happiness as people celebrated together, not knowing the things that were to come and just trusting God for the next step. This meal was the Lord's Supper. It's a time when Jesus broke bread and drank wine with his disciples, reminding them of a time when he wouldn't be with them. And yet they should do this meal continually in order to remember him. We're going to take the Lord's Supper together now. I'm going to pray in a moment, but before we do that, the Lord's Supper is a time when people who believe in Jesus, who have welcomed him into their lives, can take bread and wine or